This programming is sponsored by Linscombe Wealth, a wealth management firm partnering with individuals and families dedicated to helping them build, preserve, and manage wealth by creating a customized plan to work toward achieving their goals. More at linscombewealth.com.
Welcome to Party Politics. I'm Brandon Rottinghouse, a political science professor from the University of Houston.
And I'm Jay Iyer, a political science professor from Texas Southern University. Thanks for joining us as we talk a little politics every week. Brandon, so much to talk about. We've got walls, we've got Green New Deals, we got a shutdown that looks like it's not going to happen.
Averted, maybe.
Oh, I think so. We'll see. Let's hope. We can hope. And of course, we've got the fittest president in the history of the presidency in Donald J. Trump. But before we get to all that fun stuff, let's go right into it. Let's talk the Democratic election that will never end, the primary that keeps growing and growing and growing. Second by second, we get new person in. This week, we've gotten, I think, probably the best announcement I have seen. Amy Klobuchar, the senior senator from Minnesota, gave one of the, I thought, the coolest, pardon the pun, announcements ever in a driving snowstorm.
Right.
Outside, no quiver in her voice. She barely had a coat on. Gave this full-throated 20-minute announcement speech. And I can't imagine. I've never seen anything like that before. And I loved her tweet to Donald Trump when he was critical of her, talking about global warming, where she's like, my hair did fine. I don't know about yours.
Right. How would your hair fare in the blizzard, right? I thought she was going to have to, like, cut open a tauntaun and, like, live inside of it for a night to survive the snowstorm. If you haven't seen the visuals on this, pause the podcast and go look at it because it is one of the most bizarre things. It reminded me of 1968 when Edmund Muskie was doing a speech in New Hampshire and he was reported to have been crying.
Oh, yeah.
The staff said it wasn't. It was snowflakes, but that reminded me of this moment.
Yeah, except she didn't cry. I mean, it was cold, and she kept going and going, and I almost felt bad for the audience.
Well, and I think substantively, it was the right thing to do. I mean, obviously, it was bad timing in terms of the snowstorm, but she did it in front of this bridge along Interstate 35 that had collapsed and killed 13 people in 2007. This was, I think, a moment for her to be able to kind of capture one slice of this, which is about infrastructure and about the need to invest. So I thought that was probably, even though the snowstorm made it look like it was very uncomfortable, I thought that was a good kind of way for her to carve off a part of this. But it's not an unchecked kind of announcement, Jay, because there were words coming out of Washington about how she mistreats her staff. She had been rebuked by Harry Reid, who at the time was the Senate minority leader, for basically, you know, her behavior, which was fairly aggressive towards staff. I think the bottom line here is that no candidate is going to get off of this unscathed and no announcement is going to be clean. So the goal here is to try to carve off a piece of the Democratic Party for yourself. And I think she probably did that pretty well.
Yeah, I thought she was great. I mean, look, as far as the lead up to it, where there were negative stories about how she treated staff, I think, let's be clear about this. I think we hear a lot of these stories, particularly when the politician or the elected official is a woman. We rarely hear it when it's a man. I think there's a massive double standard here. Amy Klobuchar, for a good part of her term, was often, you know, they often described as sort of Minnesota nice.
Right.
There was an actual argument, is she too nice to deal with Donald Trump and challenge Donald Trump? Well, clearly that's not the case, apparently.
Well, ask her staff, yeah.
Yeah. And she's certainly tough enough because I can tell you, I can't imagine another politician standing there because it was literal blizzard conditions. And what struck me was not just the visuals, but I heard the speech. Her voice didn't even shake.
Yeah.
It was cold out there.
The Minnesotans are used to that. It's snowing all the time there.
Yeah,
right?
It's like
winter,
nothing
summer,
for her.
Fall, everything, right?
Yeah, it's like nothing for her.
Well, the field keeps growing. Governor Steve Bullock from Montana is traveling to Iowa. He might throw his hat into the ring. Kamala Harris is dealing with some issues with respect to her embracing of medical marijuana and marijuana more broadly. Jay, what's going on
there?
Yeah,
that's right. Senator Harris came out on a morning radio program called The Breakfast Club where she said that she was in favor of the legalization of marijuana, which is legal in California, not just decriminalization, but actual legalization, and went as far to say that, yes, she did smoke, yes, she inhaled, and got her dates, shall we say, a little hazy, and claimed
it couldn't have been the pot, right?
Never, and claimed to have been listening to to Tupac while this was happening, except, you know, Tupac hadn't released an album until years after she had graduated from high school.
Well, hey, so she went to Howard, right, which is in D.C., and Tupac was from the East Coast, from Baltimore, so maybe she was listening to stuff that was, like, kind of pre-album? I don't know, right?
Yeah.
Let's take her at her word. I mean, maybe the pot got in the way of her memory,
I think Tupac was in middle school when she was at Howard, so it might have been a little bit dicey.
He's
there.
He's prolific, but not that prolific.
I understand what you're saying. I think she's trying to relate to the kids, shall we say,
gotcha,
and probably exaggerated some of the specifics about what she was listening to. But Brandon, speaking about smoking green, we've got a Green New Deal, apparently, and that has created quite the firestorm for what in many ways is kind of a meaningless resolution. Tell us what's this all about.
Yeah, so as you say, this is basically a resolution of sort of principles that many of the left of the Democratic Party are pushing. So it includes just a Christmas list of Democratic wants, like investing in infrastructure for energy efficiency, clean manufacturing, overhauling transportation to reduce greenhouse gas emissions in the next 10 years, things like sustainable living wage, family medical leave, just a whole host of things. You're probably going to find a Tickle Me Elmo on there and like maybe a Cabbage Patch Kid, right? Just every sort of want. My thinking here is that there's a potential and a problem for the Democrats to kind of overcorrect to the left. They're already getting a lot of pushback from almost every Republican, including Ted Cruz, who calls it kooky and says it's going to do things like ban cars and trains and cattle, which is not going to do. But I think that the kind of pragmatic Democratic Party here is in some peril because it's totally impractical that these things could all happen, especially all at once. So I worry that there's a kind of movement away from the kind of central tendency for the party to be able to kind of get some movement on these policies when you put them all on the same, you know, ticket.
Yeah, the nicest thing you could say about the Green New Deal resolution as it's been put out is that it is a moonshot. It is a document designed to try to be, I think, optimistic about what could be achieved.
Yeah.
The reality of it is, and I think, is that it's a completely fictitious document for a good chunk of it. It's almost scientifically impossible to wean us off of fossil fuels in its entirety within a decade. It's just almost scientifically impossible to do that. It would destroy good chunks of the United States and economy. But I recognize sort of the zeal for it. I think they would have been better off presenting an actual plan. The problem for Democrats now is this, is that you've got an energized left that is essentially saying you must support the Green New Deal. The problem is it creates a sort of target where it looks like, for example, here in Texas, you had two members, Joaquin Castro being one of them, signing on to a deal that effectively would destroy about 75% of the Texas economy. It's an unworkable.
Well, that's what I mean.
Form.
I mean, if the Dems are going to move that far to the left, it could be a problem. Although almost every Democratic senator running for president has signed it on as a co-sponsor here. Harris, Warren, Klobuchar, Gillibrand, and Booker, but not Sherrod Brown, who's going to try to take that middle route. So I don't know exactly where it's going to shake out here, but it's definitely the case that this is something which is very pie in the sky. I'm not sure it's going to go anywhere, and it could have a political backfire. Well, Jay, it wouldn't be a week in American politics without a billionaire and the media and extortion. So we've got an interesting case here of Jeff Bezos, one of the richest people in the world. I'm sure you've all used Amazon and maybe even read the Washington Post. He is essentially here causing a little bit of a ruckus because he's accusing the National Enquirer of extortion and blackmail. Jay, what is happening on this?
What's essentially happening is that Jeff Bezos, the owner of Amazon, and as you said, the richest man in the world, is in a dispute with the National Enquirer because they initially had published photos and documents related to his affair that he was having, but also threatened to expose even more if Bezos did not stop trying to investigate where he was getting it. And the lawyers for the National Enquirer had basically threatened him that they would release more if he didn't stop. And so Jeff Bezos, instead of paying him off, so to speak, and going quietly into the night, decided he was going to expose it and wrote a pretty extensive blog piece on the site Medium where he let the world know that the National Enquirer was blackmailing him.
Yeah, the lawyers for the Enquirer say that they aren't sure it happened, but no matter what, this is below the belt. right?
Yes, below the belt.
Sorry, I had to
yes,
do
and,
it.
And it didn't help that the National Enquirer CEO is aptly named. His last name is Pecker.
Right. Well, and the political connection here is that that Trump and Pecker, David Pecker, are close, and there's been all kinds of swirling rumors about what it is that they are up to. And
right,
that,
because David Pecker and AMI, the parent company of the National Enquirer, had engaged in this process of what we call catch and kill. They would essentially buy up negative stories related to President Trump, and they would never see the light of day. So there, as we know, there's been about a dozen women who have accused the president of either sexual harassment or some sort of sexual misconduct. They would purchase these stories and essentially not publish them, which is the exact opposite of what you normally do. They're in the midst of part of the Russiagate investigation, and they had cut a deal with Robert Mueller. It was a plea deal. And so the question is whether this activity related to Jeff Bezos invalidates that plea agreement. And that brings us all the way back to the White House scandal du jour.
There you go. Well, let's talk more about the White House here. The president went to El Paso to build support for his border wall, and who should he meet there but Beto O'Rourke, the former member of the House, failed Senate candidate. What are the politics behind this, Jay? And is this something that the president can get some traction on?
Yeah, the prodigal son, Beto O'Rourke, was wandering in the desert, so to speak, trying to find himself, and lo and behold, he
it
got
was
help
there all
from,
along, right?
All along.
All along at home,
yes,
right?
The president of the United States decided to essentially pull him back in into the 2020 talk and basically kind of reinvigorate Beto-mania by deciding to come to his hometown and do a rally for the wall, inexplicably in a city that is like 75% Democratic. And it energized O'Rourke, seemed to get him out of his funk. He leads this march of 7,000-8,000 people, and made for television moment while the president is speaking. Beto O'Rourke was speaking at a rally, kind of open air, what we saw during the campaign, and they CNN and others ran the split screen as we anticipated.
Yeah. Nothing screams, you know, you should run for president like, you know, tens of thousands of people shouting your name and encouraging you. So this might be the moment that Beto O'Rourke decided to get into that race. We will see. Obviously, there's a lot of room between now and then, but this is going to be the big issue of 2020. I think the president sort of has certainly laid that gauntlet down, and it's brought O'Rourke back in. Jeff Rowe, who was Ted Cruz's political consultant, said that O'Rourke was on a bong tour of Southwest America, and this is something that Democratic voters want to see, not that. So the end of that, I think, is probably a good thing for O'Rourke. It gives him the ability to be able to be front and center. The president tweeted out or suggested during the speech that, you know, that Beto has nothing going for him except his name, which may be enough, honestly, given how many, you know, bumper stickers and yard signs you see. To me, the big loser here is Julian Castro, who looks like he's on the outside looking on this issue, right? This was an issue tailor-made for him to attack Donald Trump on, and here you've got O'Rourke right in the middle of it again.
Yeah, the interesting thing, in addition to that, to me, is that it redefines what we're talking about as what the 2020 election will be. We're talking about this later as it relates to the shutdown and the wall funding and all of that. But immigration and the wall will continue to permeate the 2020 election. That is still going to be, that's President Trump's kind of go-to issue. And that's an issue that other candidates, other than Julian Castro and Beto O'Rourke, are the only two that really talk about this issue.
Yeah.
Everyone else wants to talk about income inequality. Other Democrats want to talk about health care. You've got folks wanting to talk about a Green New Deal. This issue, the immigration issue, the wall, the only two people, I think, in the race positioned to really take the immigration fight to Donald Trump are Beto O'Rourke and Julian Castro.
Yeah.
So if the Republicans decide to make that front and center, the Democrats' best position to go after him are those two. And so it'll be interesting to see if this affects the 2020 primary cycle.
Yeah, I mean, given that the president really has a significant ability to control the agenda on these kinds of things, I think that if he wants it to be about this, it will be. And I think he does want that. Hey, here's a good news coming out of Washington. The president is apparently in very good health. Jay, tell us about it.
Yeah, so the president of the United States had his annual physical As we know from previous physicals that he has had, both during the campaign and then his first year in office, the notations from his physicians have been, shall we say, a little speculative. The president's weight, and apparently he is the healthiest man to ever be in the White House. The fact that he can't seemingly go up a flight of stairs, notwithstanding, this president has been deemed to be in perfect health. I'm going to call BS on that one, Brandon.
Well, he plays a lot of golf, so maybe that's one thing.
And he rides a cart. He doesn't even walk.
That's right. The cart is not a good use of his battery, Jay, which is his theory about how the world works, right? People have a certain amount of energy, just like a battery, and exercising does no good, according to Trump's theory of this. So either he should write a book on on how this all plays out, or this should be ignored. I think it should be ignored. The problem with these kinds of things is that they only offer the kind of false reassurance. You're never going to know the full story of what's happening. And I don't think the president's physician should be in any kind of position to tell us exactly what the president is, you know, ailing the president. But if for sure it's the case that if he's in good shape, we should know it. If he's in bad shape, we should know that too. We got to the point where we knew things about like presidents like Jimmy Carter's hemorrhoids, which were, you know, obviously just too much. We don't need to know all of that detail, right?
Well, but I mean, I think in all seriousness, this is a relevant issue. I mean, we've had presidents in the past. They've consistently released medical records. George W. Bush famously did. Bill Clinton did. Barack Obama did. Dick Cheney had to because of the issues with his heart when he was vice president. The president of the United States is a 70-plus-year-old man. He is overweight. He is not the healthiest person physically. I think it is not something that we should be hiding from because we should know whether or not he's capable of actually being in office. I joke about this, but it's been reported. He doesn't like to take the stairs. He rides an elevator to go up one flight.
Hey, who can blame him, though, right? Like, hey, you know what might help is that he has installed a golf simulator in the White House. This replaces the one that the Obama administration
Because he's not getting to play enough golf, Brandon.
More
think about that.
More golf, right? More golf is better. It's a little bit of a workout, right?
We have now found the answer to what's happening during executive time.
Right. Well, let's talk Texas, Jay. We're talking about the U.S. Senate race, which is rapidly coming upon us in 2020 here. Some news this week suggests that MJ Hager, who is a former House candidate who got very close to unseating a long-term member of Congress, is considering a run against John Cornyn. One holdup here, she says that if Wendy Davis considers running, that she won't. Another piece of news is that Beto O'Rourke has also met with Chuck Schumer to talk about what's going to happen in 2020. I think Julian Castro is probably thinking, that'd be great if you did that. Beto, love to see you in that race and not in Iowa. So kind of a lot of swirling going on here. What's your take on where this race is?
Well, I think the number one choice for most Texans from an idealized Democratic perspective would probably be Beto O'Rourke if he's not running for president. But I think MJ Hager is clearly the number two choice, certainly better than Wendy Davis, who suffered, I want to say, to put it kindly, a historic defeat.
Yeah.
She was completely annihilated by Greg Abbott in a race that was, frankly, wasted. MJ Hager ran a fantastic race. Purely viral race. That is a district that should have never been remotely competitive. It was farthest away, and she did a remarkable job. She's got a great biography, a great story. She's a former combat pilot, and I think would make a great contrast to what we're seeing and sort of consistent with sort of the new modern Democratic Party. Wendy Davis, you know, unfairly or fairly, is just not a viable candidate statewide anymore.
Yeah, I think that loss was fairly stinging, and I don't know that she's going to recover from that. The party, though, has recovered. I think the bench is as deep as it's been for them since the 1990s. The problem is that if you can't manage the candidates who are going to emerge and run against various incumbents, Republican incumbents, then it could create a kind of backlog, and that could create bad feelings. So this is a good problem for the Democrats to have, but it could potentially turn into a negative. So my guess is that if Hager doesn't choose to run, if she wants to run again for the House, then it's going to be somebody else who lost who doesn't want to run for the House, maybe like Joseph Kopster or Gina Ortiz Jones, somebody who might want to go statewide instead of going more local. The money's there. I mean, Hager raised about $5 million. Cornyn's got about six in the bank already, but I think in terms of fundraising that the Texas Republicans are still playing coach pitch. I mean, they're never going to be able to keep up. And the Democrats are already at, you know, AA Corpus Christi, right? They're able to generate a lot of money very quickly.
Well, and Hager in particular has a national fundraising base.
Yeah.
Her videos went viral. She was sort of a national star in terms of raising money. And I think that would continue. So in that sense, she'd be a perfect candidate for it.
Yeah. Well, let's talk finances on a different scale, Jay. Senate Bill 2, as well as House Bill 2, is the property tax reform bill. In effect, this is legislation which would require automatic elections, allowing for voters to approve any property tax revenue increases that exceed 2.5%. Now, counties and cities and community college districts and school districts are exempt if they raise less than $15 million, but that still leaves a lot of counties and school districts and cities on this map. So what's going to happen here with SB2, Jay?
Yeah, well, I think SB2 probably passes. It's got a companion bill in the House.
It passes at 2.5%.
Yeah, you know, that's really the big question, right? I think there's going to be some tweaking of the percentages, but I think the principle of it, of that that automatic rollback trigger, probably does happen. Look, the polling is clear on those. Property taxes are a huge problem. Whether or not the data entirely supports it, I think the real issue for Republicans is they have focused on this because they know it resonates among suburban voters. I think Democrats are making a huge mistake not coming up with their own version of property tax relief.
Yeah.
Why the Democrats have not put out a bill, for example, that expands the homestead exemption or that puts in some of the reforms that Mike Collier, the lieutenant governor nominee, had put out, calling for sort of changes in the way appraisal rates are calculated. Those are the kinds of things they need to do to combat it. I'm surprised why they're just essentially ceding property tax reform or relief, which is the number one issue for many voters, entirely to Republicans.
I think it's a good point. Look, the fiscal note on this bill is not clear about what the impact on school finance will be because they don't know yet since they haven't filed that bill yet. But it's definitely the case that it indicates by 2024 that these counties and cities are going to lose up to $3 billion in revenue. That's a lot of local services which aren't going to get paid for. So this is a major problem. I think your hunch is right. I think it'll pass, but not at 2.5%. This was the big fight in 2017 that basically like ended the special session. So I don't think you're going to get it that low.
Well, the difference, I will say this. Back then, Bonin was against it. Well, this session, he's for it.
Maybe, but you also have got 12 more Republican, 10 more Democrats in the mix, right? And you also have, I think, unanimity among local governments, except in Collin County, that say that we don't want this. This is going to basically, you know, bankrupt us. So I think that you're going to find something here, but maybe not exactly this. There is an effort in the House to make this a little bit more nuanced so that maybe it's the case that there's going to be some sales tax exemptions, which might be used to pay for this and offset some of these differences. So you're going to find some maneuvering here, but I think you're right. This is an important issue, but it's going to be hard to see this pass as it is because you're not going to get the Republicans on board.
Well, the Secretary of State, as we talked about in the past, has been mired in a bunch of problems. He was actually a recess appointment and is only now coming up for confirmation. Normally, these things are sleepy affairs, Brandon, but David Whitley is in big, big trouble.
Right.
Is he going to actually become a confirmed Secretary of State?
Yeah, oddly enough, it was the case that this was going to sail through, but as it turns out, the Don Buckingham has decided to delay the vote, which is legislative speak for we don't have the votes. So he got some pretty tough questions. We said last week that this was going to be a major problem for him if he couldn't come clean on these things, and he didn't. I mean, effectively, he kind of doubled down on what they did. He just basically pushed aside issues of like voter purge and voter suppression, saying that these things weren't like the terms they use and it wasn't important to him. It just didn't look right. The optics were quite bad. In the short term, there's not much the Democrats can do except to hope for inaction. And the AG has said he won't enforce this and won't act on this. But the long term is going to be a battle in the courts, right?
Brandon, we've had three quick little proposals related to the wall that I would describe as Looney Tunes, Brandon. Number one, Texas Freedom Caucus has been proposing using the rainy day fund for the wall. Apparently, we can't use it for Harvey, but these guys want to use it to build a wall that is dubious at best. Our Lieutenant Governor Dan Patrick is saying, hey, border walls are great. In fact, it will prevent beheadings from drug lords and bad actors. And speaking on that team of drug lords and bad actors, our own Senator Ted Cruz has said, hey, I have an idea how to fund the wall. Let's let El Chapo and the drug lords pay for it.
Well, he's going to go in the desert and like dig up the money bags that were left.
That's right. Apparently,
there's
$14 billion that El Chapo is hidden away somewhere. We can use all that money. But lo and behold, none of these things, I think, are going anywhere.
Well, the Freedom Caucus, I think, is grasping at straws here. They want to be politically relevant, and they're basically kind of shriveling up a little bit in the ledge, and I think that this is an opportunity for them to kind of play to their base. It's not going to work. Dan Patrick, I think, is doing what Trump should have done. I mean, if you want to create a crisis moment, you need to really ramp up that rhetoric. And this discussion about beheadings and all of the crazy things that happen, I think, is the way to do it. He hasn't been doing it. And we know that Patrick is quite good at it.
Well, let's talk about the wall, Brandon. Let's talk about the deal, what's going to happen, what's not going to happen. The president had wanted a wall. It doesn't look like he's going to get certainly the $5.5 billion that he wanted. In fact, it doesn't look like he's going to get much at all. He's actually getting less than what he vetoed the last time. This is one of those odd circumstances, but assuming he signs on to this compromise measure, we will not have a government shutdown. We'll have a little over $1 billion to replace and some of the existing border issues, and we'll probably see a net of about 55 additional miles to go along with the 600 or 700 or so that are already built. So now, as you probably saw from the rally, we're no longer building a wall. We are finishing the wall.
Right. I think this just underscores a couple of things. I mean, the first is that America apparently can't govern itself without a crisis. And we are probably through this moment, right? Maybe temporarily, because the debt ceiling is going to be another fight that has to come up in March. So you and I are going to be talking about that in not too long. For the Republicans, I think that they were able to kind of temporarily rein in Trump and tame him a little bit. We'll see if that holds and the degree to which he wants to bring back this kind of rhetoric, in a couple of months. The Democrats, I think, get to fight on and they get to focus on their priorities. We talked about the new Green Deal. Maybe that all won't go, but some parts of it will go. The Judiciary Committee is talking about expanding federal background checks for people who are purchasing firearms. So they want to talk about something new. For them, there's no education in the second kick of a mule, right? They've already won this fight. They want to move on. I think this gets them to that point.
Yeah, I think this is a win-win, ironically. The president, in a weird sort of way, gets what he wants. He doesn't get the wall. He gets to continue to talk about needing the wall. He gets to continue talking about the border in crisis. And for the Democrats, they get to essentially, from a governance perspective, get this off the agenda. The losers, I think, in some ways can be, and we talked a little bit about this earlier, are for Democrats in 2020. A lot of the energy of the Trump campaign is going to be driven again around immigration, around the wall, and all these sordid issues, and less on the kinds of things that Democrats want to talk about.
Yeah.
And so I think depending on who the Democratic nominee is, it could become a real problem for them. Look, if Bernie Sanders is the Democratic nominee, he just has no interest. This is not his issue, right? And whether it's him, even Joe Biden, it's not their issue. So if you look at some of the leading candidates, it becomes a problem because immigration is not their core kind of thing. And that, I think, works to Trump's favor. He was never going to get a wall. We know that it's superfluous. Even if you got $5 billion, most of the remaining property on the border, certainly here in Texas, is held in private hands. Eminent domain and litigation, it would take years to build this thing. This was always a political device, nothing more.
But there's some downsides, though, too, for Republicans. You know, if they bit hard on the bit to get the wall and back Trump, they didn't get it, or they didn't get all of it. So they're going to have to explain that. The Democrats, maybe on one good thing, they get to watch, right? They get to oversee. They get to make sure that Trump doesn't try to do some back means to get this built, so, or more of it built. So this is, I think, still a hold moment for politics, but at least we're through this crisis, which, you know, given how many standoffs we have in this country on these kinds of issues, is probably a good thing.
Well, that's it for this week. Party Politics is recorded in the George B. Geary Performance Studio at Houston Public Media.
Big thanks to our coordinating producer, who has vowed to keep the pod running through September, Ernie Manous. Special kudos to our web and graphics team here at Houston Public Media. And finally, thanks to our audio engineer, Todd, the stable genius, Holslander.
I'm Jay Iyer.
And I'm Brandon Rottinghouse. We'll see you next week.